Cambridge Certificate of Proficiency in English Listening Test. Ahead Books, written by Sean Houghton. Test 4. I am going to give you the instructions for this test. I shall introduce each part of the test and give you time to look at the questions. At the start of each piece, you will hear this sound. You will hear each piece twice. Remember, while you're listening, write your answers on the question paper. You will have 5 minutes at the end of the real test to copy your answers onto the separate answer sheet. In the exam, there would now be a pause. Please ask any questions you have during the pause, because you must not speak during the test. Now open your question paper and look at part one. You will hear three different extracts. For questions 1 to 6, choose the answer A, B or C, which fits best according to what you hear. There are two questions for each extract. Extract 1. You will hear two speakers on a current affairs show, Raoul and Erica, discussing the causes for optimism and pessimism in today's world.
Erica, many people are worried about the state of our world, and I can sympathize with them. Indeed, I share their concerns. People, for example, in elections, are tending to vote more and more for the extremes, where the center used to always get the most support. How can you be so optimistic about the future?
I admit, Raoul, that all is not hunky-dory. However, the world we live in has always been far from perfect. I don't dismiss your concern either about certain trends, particularly those in politics. However, I see other trends that give me cause for hope. Besides, I think we have a new generation to be proud of. When they're polled and asked for their views, they do not share the same negativity as current voting generations. They express their ideologies in terms of a more inclusive and united world. I look forward to the day when they're old enough to cast their vote.
I don't share your enthusiasm for this inclusivity, actually. I think globalization is part and parcel of the problem.
Well, on this, we are poles apart. For me, it's the only solution. In a world where everyone has to work and function together, we have, ultimately, to do the best for the greater good, whether we want to or not. In such a world, we all have a vested interest in the same thing. If what affects one person affects the other, then suddenly there is common ground. They must cooperate because both endure the same struggle. This is what I love about globalization.
Erica, many people are worried about the state of our world, and I can sympathize with them. Indeed, I share their concerns. People, for example, in elections, are tending to vote more and more for the extremes, where the center used to always get the most support. How can you be so optimistic about the future?
I admit, Raoul, that all is not hunky-dory. However, the world we live in has always been far from perfect. I don't dismiss your concern either about certain trends, particularly those in politics. However, I see other trends that give me cause for hope. Besides, I think we have a new generation to be proud of. When they're polled and asked for their views, they do not share the same negativity as current voting generations. They express their ideologies in terms of a more inclusive and united world. I look forward to the day when they're old enough to cast their vote.
I don't share your enthusiasm for this inclusivity, actually. I think globalization is part and parcel of the problem.
Well, on this, we are poles apart. For me, it's the only solution. In a world where everyone has to work and function together, we have, ultimately, to do the best for the greater good, whether we want to or not. In such a world, we all have a vested interest in the same thing. If what affects one person affects the other, then suddenly there is common ground. They must cooperate because both endure the same struggle. This is what I love about globalization.
Extract 2. You will hear two film critics, Gemma and Henry, discussing a new movie release on the radio.
Did you not think the acting was a little over the top?
Personally, I love the chemistry, Gemma.
Oh, there's no denying that was there for all to see. That's not exactly what I meant. But I thought they over-dramatised things a little, making for quite sloppy performances. It could have done with a more serious undertone, because it lacked sincerity, in my opinion.
Well, I felt they got the balance just right, actually. Had they mellowed their performances, I think the otherwise quite dull plot would have been exposed.
True, Henry. But a story should speak for itself. It shouldn't have to be propped up by the actors.
Well, I agree with you there. But nonetheless, that was necessary. Indeed, I give the production team full credit for their casting. But that's where I draw the line. I was left underwhelmed by the rest. This was a whisker away from being a really good watch. It had all the ingredients, with a strong cast and a savvy director. But it lacked any depth, and instead was a complete letdown. I think they, cast and director, got every ounce of value they could out of what they had to work with in that regard. Very limited resources.
Yes, it's certainly disappointing that such a well-financed production began with such a vacuous plot at the starting point. Did you not think the acting was a little over the top?
Personally, I love the chemistry, Gemma.
Oh, there's no denying that was there for all to see. That's not exactly what I meant. But I thought they over-dramatised things a little, making for quite sloppy performances. It could have done with a more serious undertone, because it lacked sincerity, in my opinion.
Well, I felt they got the balance just right, actually. Had they mellowed their performances, I think the otherwise quite dull plot would have been exposed.
True, Henry. But a story should speak for itself. It shouldn't have to be propped up by the actors.
Well, I agree with you there. But nonetheless, that was necessary. Indeed, I give the production team full credit for their casting. But that's where I draw the line. I was left underwhelmed by the rest. This was a whisker away from being a really good watch. It had all the ingredients, with a strong cast and a savvy director. But it lacked any depth, and instead was a complete letdown. I think they, cast and director, got every ounce of value they could out of what they had to work with in that regard. Very limited resources.
Yes, it's certainly disappointing that such a well-financed production began with such a vacuous plot at the starting point.
Extract 3. You will hear part of a radio interview with a safari guide called Rihanna.
Rihanna, you are a walking safari guide. That sounds rather dangerous.
Yes, well, there is certainly an element of risk, and I wouldn't discount it completely. However, in all my years doing this, I have seldom found myself in a compromising position.
But you are going on foot through grassland occupied by the big cats, some of the most fearsome predators on the planet. The lion, for instance, is king for a reason, is it not?
Certainly, lions are ferocious predators, but while I would rather avoid close encounters with any big cats, give me a whole pride of lions any day over a solitary leopard in a tree.
Really? And why is that?
Because they, lions, don't tend to call your bluff. They, for the most part, will false charge and not carry through.
And leopards?
Leopards hunt by stealth. So if a leopard is stalking you, by the time you realise, it is possibly already too late. This type of encounter is not accidental, whereas most with a pride are.
And hyenas? There appears to be an abundance of them on the plains. The cackle of hyena laughter echoes all around.
Yes, and they have quite fearsome jaws. The strongest bite, pound for pound, perhaps of all these grassland predators. not to be underestimated, certainly. Logically, therefore, you ought to be extremely wary around them. However, I have found hyenas to be, for the most part, very disinclined to bother humans. They'd rather exit the scene post-haste. Remember, although competent hunters, not incapable of taking on big prey, these creatures are, by and large, opportunists and scavengers, and we are not seen as viable opportunities, thank goodness.
Rihanna, you are a walking safari guide. That sounds rather dangerous.
Yes, well, there is certainly an element of risk, and I wouldn't discount it completely. However, in all my years doing this, I have seldom found myself in a compromising position.
But you are going on foot through grassland occupied by the big cats, some of the most fearsome predators on the planet. The lion, for instance, is king for a reason, is it not?
Certainly, lions are ferocious predators, but while I would rather avoid close encounters with any big cats, give me a whole pride of lions any day over a solitary leopard in a tree.
Really? And why is that?
Because they, lions, don't tend to call your bluff. They, for the most part, will false charge and not carry through.
And leopards?
Leopards hunt by stealth. So if a leopard is stalking you, by the time you realise, it is possibly already too late. This type of encounter is not accidental, whereas most with a pride are.
And hyenas? There appears to be an abundance of them on the plains. The cackle of hyena laughter echoes all around.
Yes, and they have quite fearsome jaws. The strongest bite, pound for pound, perhaps of all these grassland predators. Not to be underestimated, certainly. Logically, therefore, you ought to be extremely wary around them. However, I have found hyenas to be, for the most part, very disinclined to bother humans. They'd rather exit the scene post-haste. Remember, although competent hunters, not incapable of taking on big prey, these creatures are, by and large, opportunists and scavengers, and we are not seen as viable opportunities, thank goodness.
That is the end of part one. Now turn to part two. You will hear a mountain rescue team leader called Sean McKinley giving a talk on avalanche awareness on a daily radio show. For questions 7 to 15, complete the sentences with a word or short phrase. You now have 45 seconds in which to look at part two.
Thank you for having me on the show today. My name is Sean McKinley, and I'm here to discuss avalanche awareness and safety, which is particularly important at this time of year. I do not want to put people off exploring our wonderful hills and mountains, but as a mountain rescue team leader who has seen the worst consequences of ignorance, I would like people to be well informed so that they can make good decisions out there. So, first and foremost, what causes an avalanche? Well, typically the culprit is the force of gravity. That is what produces a natural avalanche in most cases when conditions are right. Such snowslips are known as spontaneous avalanches. Other less typical causes of natural avalanches include rock falls and, rarer still, of course, seismic events such as earthquakes and volcanic eruptions. Although such geological phenomena are extremely rare in most parts of the world, obviously, given the unique set of geological conditions we are faced with here in the Pacific Ring of Fire, they present a much more real and present threat to us, and one we can do little to control. What we can control, however, is our own behaviour, which is to blame for a disproportionate number of avalanches which result in human injuries or fatalities. I'm referring, of course, to human-triggered avalanches. But more on this later. For now, let me just say that around 90% of avalanche victims trigger their own avalanche, and let that sink in. There are two main types of avalanche: powder avalanches and slab avalanches. The former occur during or shortly after periods of intense snowfall, on days when winds are very light or non-existent. You will almost never see one in the absence of snowfall, because once lying snow has gone through the thawing and freezing cycle, it takes on a different composition to fresh powder and becomes part of the main snowpack. As a rule of thumb, watch out for more than 30 centimeters of continuous buildup of snow in one day, or more than 2 centimeters in 1 hour. The latter, on the other hand, can occur at any time when there is a vulnerability in the existing snowpack. Snow builds up in layers, and if there are weak layers of poorly bonded snow beneath the surface, this can cause upper layers to break away and slide. Slab avalanches most frequently happen on slopes of between 30 and 45 degrees, so extra caution should be exercised at such angles. The risk of being avalanched is also highest when you are positioned lower down ridges. So, already we have identified some of the major risk factors, such as slope angle and snowfall intensity. Another major risk factor is sudden temperature change. This can disrupt the snowpack and lead to instabilities. Heavy rain can also sometimes destabilize the snowpack by making the snow wetter and consequently denser, with the increased density raising the likelihood of wet snow avalanches. A similar problem can occur without precipitation, when temperatures rise suddenly and sharply, causing thawing. Again, a wetter, denser snowpack is the result. Another factor always at play is wind speed. Strong winds can deposit more snow on lee or downwind slopes, and even when there is no new snow, such winds can redeposit snow from the existing snowpack on the same lee slopes. During and directly after such windy periods, great care should be taken in selecting slopes to traverse. Signs that there have been gales recently can often be seen in the presence of large cornices or overhanging snow tops on peaks and ridge edges, not to mention in raised footprints in the snow itself. So clearly, when considering a day out in the hills, forewarned is definitely forearmed. Also, we should not forget the importance of...
Now you will hear part two again.
Thank you for having me on the show today. My name is Sean McKinley, and I'm here to discuss avalanche awareness and safety, which is particularly important at this time of year. I do not want to put people off exploring our wonderful hills and mountains, but as a mountain rescue team leader who has seen the worst consequences of ignorance, I would like people to be well informed so that they can make good decisions out there. So, first and foremost, what causes an avalanche? Well, typically the culprit is the force of gravity. That is what produces a natural avalanche in most cases when conditions are right. Such snow slips are known as spontaneous avalanches. Other less typical causes of natural avalanches include rock falls and, rarer still, of course, seismic events such as earthquakes and volcanic eruptions. Although such geological phenomena are extremely rare in most parts of the world, obviously, given the unique set of geological conditions we are faced with here in the Pacific Ring of Fire, they present a much more real and present threat to us, and one we can do little to control. What we can control, however, is our own behavior. which is to blame for a disproportionate number of avalanches which result in human injuries or fatalities. I'm referring, of course, to human-triggered avalanches. But more on this later. For now, let me just say that around 90% of avalanche victims trigger their own avalanche, and let that sink in. There are two main types of avalanche: powder avalanches and slab avalanches. The former occur during or shortly after periods of intense snowfall, on days when winds are very light or non-existent. You will almost never see one in the absence of snowfall, because once lying snow has gone through the thawing and freezing cycle, it takes on a different composition to fresh powder and becomes part of the main snowpack. As a rule of thumb, watch out for more than 30 centimeters of continuous buildup of snow in one day, or more than 2 centimeters in 1 hour. The latter, on the other hand, can occur at any time when there is a vulnerability in the existing snowpack. Snow builds up in layers, and if there are weak layers of poorly bonded snow beneath the surface, this can cause upper layers to break away and slide. Slab avalanches most frequently happen on slopes of between 30 and 45 degrees, so extra caution should be exercised at such angles. The risk of being avalanched is also highest when you are positioned lower down ridges. So, already we have identified some of the major risk factors, such as slope angle and snowfall intensity. Another major risk factor is sudden temperature change. This can disrupt the snowpack and lead to instabilities. Heavy rain can also sometimes destabilize the snowpack by making the snow wetter and consequently denser, with the increased density raising the likelihood of wet snow avalanches. A similar problem can occur without precipitation, when temperatures rise suddenly and sharply, causing thawing. Again, a wetter, denser snowpack is the result. Another factor always at play is wind speed. Strong winds can deposit more snow on lee or downwind slopes, and even when there is no new snow, such winds can redeposit snow from the existing snowpack on the same lee slopes. During and directly after such windy periods, great care should be taken in selecting slopes to traverse. Signs that there have been gales recently can often be seen in the presence of large cornices or overhanging snow tops on peaks and ridge edges, not to mention in raised footprints in the snow itself. So clearly, when considering a day out in the hills, forewarned is definitely forearmed. Also, we should not forget the importance of...
That is the end of part two. Now turn to part three. You will hear a radio program in which a caller called Callum Best and a musician called Nathan Williams are discussing the success of Williams's band. For questions 16 to 20, choose the answer A, B, C, or D, which fits best according to what you hear. You now have 1 minute in which to look at part three.
I have Callum Best on the line from Chesterfield. Callum, I believe you have a question for my next guest on today's show, Nathan Walliams, lead singer in the band Noongar Island. Welcome, Nathan. Thank you for joining me. And Callum, your question is?
Yes, my question for Nathan is what he attributes the band's success of late to.
Well, this has all happened so fast for us, Callum. I've yet to really have a chance to reflect on things properly. We've gone from playing in front of a handful of people to being household names in homes across Europe in a matter of months. So, as you can imagine, I'm still getting my head around it, to be honest with you.
Incidentally, Callum, I know you're a big fan. So what do you think is the reason for the band's success?
I would put it down to their talent. I think talent always shines through, and these guys have that in abundance. Their live performances are outstanding.
Thank you, Callum. That's very kind of you to say. Though, believe me, there are a lot of mega-talented musicians out there waiting to be discovered. We are not unique and would be kidding ourselves if we believed so or claimed that. I think a lot of it has to do with being in the right place at the right time and getting the breaks. Talent will only get you so far in this industry.
Do you not think talent is important then, Nathan?
Oh, it is certainly key, and any musician with talent will be able to forge a modestly successful music career. However, to enjoy the level of fame we are currently experiencing, I think talent alone is not the explanation for this. A lot of bands put their success down to hard work, but bands that don't rehearse a lot and make the effort are a rarity these days, so I don't buy into that. Combine the two, hard work and talent, and you will make a living in this industry. But to hit the big time is rather more of a lottery, I feel.
You have an adoring fan base, Nathan. I'm going to ask Callum why he and fellow fans are so loyal. Callum?
Well, the guys are just so down to earth. For example, the last concert of theirs I was at, they chatted and mingled with fans in the crowd prior to kicking off the show and didn't leave at the end before doing exactly the same thing again. That's fantastic. And speaking as a music fan, let me tell you that it's really appreciated. You could so easily be one of those bands which just go through the motions, but you're not. You give back so much to us.
Thank you, Callum. It's nice that our efforts are appreciated. It's not something we do consciously to promote loyalty, though, or anything like that. It would be very tiresome and an incredible amount of work if that were our sole reason for engaging with our followers. The truth of the matter is that we simply love it. We are very social guys, and it is neither tiresome nor daunting for us to connect with the crowd. It's simply the most natural thing in the world. We don't do it to impress, but because we enjoy it, and because we learn so much from what people say.
I know you're riding high now, Nathan, but how do, or did you, deal with criticism in the past, which I'm sure you've had your fair share of?
Yes, indeed. But don't be fooled into thinking success leaves one immune to criticism, because people are seldom so keen to put you down or see you fall as when you've tasted that. To be honest, we try to ignore the hyperbole on both sides of the coin. You're neither as brilliant as your biggest fans claim, nor as awful as your harshest critics make out. Never believe your own hype, but never allow yourself to be beaten down by negativity either. We just do what we love doing to the best of our ability. Whether we get criticism or otherwise, then, is irrelevant to us, because we are truly proud of what we have produced, and that is all that matters. I really think that...
Now you will hear part three again.
I have Callum Best on the line from Chesterfield. Callum, I believe you have a question for my next guest on today's show, Nathan Walliams, lead singer in the band Noongar Island. Welcome, Nathan. Thank you for joining me. And Callum, your question is?
Yes, my question for Nathan is what he attributes the band's success of late to.
Well, this has all happened so fast for us, Callum. I've yet to really have a chance to reflect on things properly. We've gone from playing in front of a handful of people to being household names in homes across Europe in a matter of months. So, as you can imagine, I'm still getting my head around it, to be honest with you.
Incidentally, Callum, I know you're a big fan. So what do you think is the reason for the band's success?
I would put it down to their talent. I think talent always shines through, and these guys have that in abundance. Their live performances are outstanding.
Thank you, Callum. That's very kind of you to say. Though, believe me, there are a lot of mega-talented musicians out there waiting to be discovered. We are not unique and would be kidding ourselves if we believed so or claimed that. I think a lot of it has to do with being in the right place at the right time and getting the breaks. Talent will only get you so far in this industry.
Do you not think talent is important then, Nathan?
Oh, it is certainly key, and any musician with talent will be able to forge a modestly successful music career. However, to enjoy the level of fame we are currently experiencing, I think talent alone is not the explanation for this. A lot of bands put their success down to hard work, but bands that don't rehearse a lot and make the effort are a rarity these days, so I don't buy into that. Combine the two, hard work and talent, and you will make a living in this industry. But to hit the big time is rather more of a lottery, I feel.
You have an adoring fan base, Nathan. I'm going to ask Callum why he and fellow fans are so loyal. Callum?
Well, the guys are just so down to earth. For example, the last concert of theirs I was at, they chatted and mingled with fans in the crowd prior to kicking off the show and didn't leave at the end before doing exactly the same thing again. That's fantastic. And speaking as a music fan, let me tell you that it's really appreciated. You could so easily be one of those bands which just go through the motions, but you're not. You give back so much to us.
Thank you, Callum. It's nice that our efforts are appreciated. It's not something we do consciously to promote loyalty, though, or anything like that. It would be very tiresome and an incredible amount of work if that were our sole reason for engaging with our followers. The truth of the matter is that we simply love it. We are very social guys, and it is neither tiresome nor daunting for us to connect with the crowd. It's simply the most natural thing in the world. We don't do it to impress, but because we enjoy it, and because we learn so much from what people say.
I know you're riding high now, Nathan, but how do or did you deal with criticism in the past, which I'm sure you've had your fair share of?
Yes, indeed. But don't be fooled into thinking success leaves one immune to criticism, because people are seldom so keen to put you down or see you fall as when you've tasted that. To be honest, we try to ignore the hyperbole on both sides of the coin. You're neither as brilliant as your biggest fans claim, nor as awful as your harshest critics make out. Never believe your own hype, but never allow yourself to be beaten down by negativity either. We just do what we love doing to the best of our ability. Whether we get criticism or otherwise, then, is irrelevant to us, because we are truly proud of what we have produced, and that is all that matters. I really think that...
That is the end of part 3. Now turn to part 4. Part 4 consists of two tasks. You will hear 5 short extracts in which people talk about their choice of professions. Look at task 1. For questions 21 to 25, choose from the list A to H what influenced each speaker's choice of university course. Now look at task 2. For questions 26 to 30, choose from the list A to H what each speaker says about their current profession. While you listen, you must complete both tasks. You now have 45 seconds in which to look at part 4. Speaker 1.
Growing up in the countryside, when I infrequently ventured into the big city with my family, the sheer scale of things would almost overwhelm me. I developed a love affair with the concrete jungle, which would profoundly influence my choice of university course later. As an appreciator, not creator of beauty, a career in architecture was off the agenda, so instead I took to photography in order to capture the visual delights of man-made structures. Ironically, though, my true passion in this field would only reveal itself back in the countryside. Having spent so much of my childhood obsessing over cityscapes, I'd failed to appreciate the ones overhead. Nowadays, armed with my tripod and camera shooting the stars, my work has brought me full circle. It's brought me home.
Speaker 2.
Born into a family of famous barristers, I was totally immersed in the world of law as a child. To say that this didn't influence my choice of university course would, of course, be nonsense. It's impossible not to be affected by your environment growing up. However, if anything, the experience pushed me in another direction. I wanted to escape this familiar world and do something, anything, different. What? I didn't know. So it was really nothing other than pure chance that first introduced me to the world of architecture at university. I picked the course not for any logical reason, but because it was near the start of the prospectus. I ought to thank my lucky stars, then, that I discovered my passion, despite the ridiculousness of the method I used.
Speaker 3.
As a child, I would obsess over the different legal shows on TV. I couldn't miss an episode or I would simply be devastated. My parents were slightly worried by my behaviour, but they didn't intervene because it seemed to have a positive influence on my schooling. It fired my ambition. Besides, I think that neither of them being professionals themselves, it made them proud that I went on to study law. I was the first person in my family to get a third-level education. However, once I started to practice, all the romantic notions I'd had about being a lawyer vanished into thin air. Law, as depicted on TV, and the reality of being a lawyer are as far removed as two stars, light years from one another.
Speaker 4.
I never gave it much thought as a child. My university path was predetermined. I would study medicine, as my parents had, making them incredibly pleased. Otherwise, they would be terribly disappointed with me. I took these as facts, without ever actually asking them, and set out on a path to make everyone happy. However, 2 years into med school, things unraveled. I was miserable. Only then, when I confided in them, did I realize my parents didn't care what I did, as long as I was happy. So I dropped out. I needed something to do until I got back on my feet and started giving stargazing tours for tourists. I turned to astronomy in my time of despair at university because I found the stars inspirational. The little rays of light or hope emerging from the darkness. So perhaps if I'd never experienced such lows, I would never have found my way into a career that has since and continues to deliver me such highs.
Speaker 5.
My childhood was incredibly unhappy. Both my parents being doctors, they were very busy and seldom around, and I had to mostly fend for myself. I struggled to make friends or fit in, and this left me very low indeed. It was only later in adolescence, after much pain and struggle, that I began to understand why. I was on the autism spectrum. I was a little different from most other people, but my differences were not things to be ashamed of. They were what made me unique as a person. So I was determined to study medicine at university, and then specialize in the fields of psychiatry and psychology in order to help other young people like me through their difficulties. My work is at times very intense and emotive, but it is incredibly fulfilling. I like to think my job is helping scarred young people find the good in themselves.
Now you will hear part 4 again. Speaker 1.
Growing up in the countryside, when I infrequently ventured into the big city with my family, the sheer scale of things would almost overwhelm me. I developed a love affair with the concrete jungle, which would profoundly influence my choice of university course later. As an appreciator, not creator of beauty, a career in architecture was off the agenda, so instead I took to photography in order to capture the visual delights of man-made structures. Ironically, though, my true passion in this field would only reveal itself back in the countryside. Having spent so much of my childhood obsessing over cityscapes, I'd failed to appreciate the ones overhead. Nowadays, armed with my tripod and camera shooting the stars, my work has brought me full circle. It's brought me home.
Speaker 2.
Born into a family of famous barristers, I was totally immersed in the world of law as a child. To say that this didn't influence my choice of university course would, of course, be nonsense. It's impossible not to be affected by your environment growing up. However, if anything, the experience pushed me in another direction. I wanted to escape this familiar world and do something, anything, different. What? I didn't know. So it was really nothing other than pure chance that first introduced me to the world of architecture at university. I picked the course not for any logical reason, but because it was near the start of the prospectus. I ought to thank my lucky stars, then, that I discovered my passion, despite the ridiculousness of the method I used.
Speaker 3.
As a child, I would obsess over the different legal shows on TV. I couldn't miss an episode or I would simply be devastated. My parents were slightly worried by my behaviour, but they didn't intervene because it seemed to have a positive influence on my schooling. It fired my ambition. Besides, I think that neither of them being professionals themselves, it made them proud that I went on to study law. I was the first person in my family to get a third-level education. However, once I started to practice, all the romantic notions I'd had about being a lawyer vanished into thin air. Law, as depicted on TV, and the reality of being a lawyer are as far removed as two stars, light years from one another.
Speaker 4.
I never gave it much thought as a child. My university path was predetermined. I would study medicine, as my parents had, making them incredibly pleased. Otherwise, they would be terribly disappointed with me. I took these as facts, without ever actually asking them, and set out on a path to make everyone happy. However, 2 years into med school, things unraveled. I was miserable. Only then, when I confided in them, did I realize my parents didn't care what I did, as long as I was happy. So I dropped out. I needed something to do until I got back on my feet and started giving stargazing tours for tourists. I turned to astronomy in my time of despair at university because I found the stars inspirational. The little rays of light or hope emerging from the darkness. So perhaps if I'd never experienced such lows, I would never have found my way into a career that has since and continues to deliver me such highs.
Speaker 5.
My childhood was incredibly unhappy. Both my parents being doctors, they were very busy and seldom around, and I had to mostly fend for myself. I struggled to make friends or fit in, and this left me very low indeed. It was only later in adolescence, after much pain and struggle, that I began to understand why. I was on the autism spectrum. I was a little different from most other people, but my differences were not things to be ashamed of. They were what made me unique as a person. So I was determined to study medicine at university, and then specialize in the fields of psychiatry and psychology in order to help other young people like me through their difficulties. My work is at times very intense and emotive, but it is incredibly fulfilling. I like to think my job is helping scarred young people find the good in themselves.
That is the end of part 4. In the actual test, There would now be a pause of 5 minutes for you to copy your answers onto the separate answer sheet. Be sure to follow the numbering of all the questions. The examiner shall remind you when there's 1 minute left, so that you're sure to finish in time.